Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to another edition here of Crime and Science Radio. This is part two of the FBI Invades the Show with very special guests Betsy Glick, Edward Yu, and Andrew Hessel. If you haven't heard part one, you can go back and listen to that. You can come back and listen to part two and go back to listen to part one, whatever you would like to do. We want to thank you, however, wherever and whenever you listen to all the shows here on Suspense Radio. You can make sure that you check out thestoryblender.com, crimeandscienceradio.com. You can go to suspenseradionetwork.com and many more places to find out. Get us on iTunes, subscribe to the podcast. You get every show when it's done, completed, right into wherever you listen and whatever you listen device you listen in. So let's just jump right into it right now because here we go. Here's your host of Crime and Science Radio, of course, Doug Lyle and Jan Burke, continuing with the FBI Invades the Show.
Well, welcome everyone back to part two of our discussion here on biotechnology and weapons of mass destruction. We have with us from the FBI, Betsy Glick, who is in the Office of Public Affairs. We have Edward Yu, who is a supervisory special agent in the FBI's Weapons of Mass Destruction Directorate Biological Countermeasures Unit. And we have Andrew Hessel, who is a futurist and catalyst in biological technologies and deeply immersed in the world of bioinformatics, biotechnology, and nanotechnology. So welcome back, everyone.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Well, I hope that our listeners who may have missed the first program will remember that we archive all of our programs, and you can find them on Crime and Science Radio. Tom and on Doug's site and on Suspense Magazine site as well, and on iTunes, and listen to that first part because you'll get a great foundation for what we're talking about today. So let me just ask, when someone says WMD, most people, their minds immediately go to nuclear weapons, but there are other classes of WMDs. Can you tell us exactly what one is?
Sure. So if you think about the federal criminal statutes actually define it, these are weapons that cause mass casualties. It can cause mass destruction, or it could have a huge economic impact, financial loss, or a combination of any of those three. So we're looking at the use of a WMD either in furtherance of a terrorist operation or some other form. But bottom line, it really is looking at mass impact. And the difference between, I would say, yes, you know, when you think of WMDs, the first thing is the mushroom cloud caused by a nuclear device. But there is a spectra, and looking at for example, a dirty bomb. Explosive devices just spread radioactive material, not a nuclear per se, but you will contaminate an area. If anything, at the very least, it'll cause mass panic and evacuations. And you're also looking at the potential chemical weapons too. They can range from, if you've seen the movie The Rock, things like VX gas to just using gas that might be cause you to asphyxiate. But you know, coming from the Biological Countermeasures Unit, bio is different in that if you think about the radiological, nuclear, and chemical world, those are very specific materials. They're highly regulated, and the expertise resides within a select small group. Bio is different in that it's wholly open, which makes it incredibly powerful and why it has been so globally beneficial for centuries. But then also poses an interesting challenge the same open source, open nature of the life sciences where you're seeing these rapid developments could potentially, that's a dual-use challenge, could be subverted for nefarious use to develop something that could cause mass destruction. And it doesn't necessarily have to cause a fatality. So, for example, foot and mouth disease, that is an agricultural agent. It doesn't kill cattle. It just makes them violently ill. But because of trade agreements, if there ever was one case of foot and mouth disease, FMD, identified in the U.S., that would completely shut down our beef market and exports. And as you can imagine, that would be a tremendous hit on our economy. And as it stands today, there's only one place in the entire U.S. that FMD is housed, and that's at the Plum Island Animal Disease Center off the coast of New York. But FMD is you can find it just about anywhere. There's plenty of sick camels over in the Middle East, but it just shows that highlights the fact that it doesn't necessarily have to cause fatalities, but can have a huge economic effect. Can also be classified as a WMD effect.
Yeah, and there's also the synthetic version of this. So, what is a synthetic bioWMD?
Well, I don't think I would classify it as a synthetic WMD per se. I work in the biological countermeasures unit. We have sister units in the nuclear radiological countermeasures, chemical countermeasures, and infrastructure protection. And those are looking at the specific modalities, the specific classifications. And our mission is one of prevention, detection, and deterrence. And for my standpoint, synthetic biology is not so much directly equates with WMD, but it's an emerging capability that could be misused in furtherance of terrorism or criminal enterprise. But that is just one angle that a technology could be misused. So it's not so much that there's a direct tie into a synthetic bioWMD, but it's misusing or subverting synthetic biology in furtherance for the development of a WMD.
So this is kind of goes back to what Andrew was saying earlier about intent, where you have something that really has the capacity for a huge amount of hope, really, for a very positive responses, but it's just a matter of who gets a hold of it and what they want to do with it.
Oh, yes, and as from our standpoint right now, that there's far more benefit than there are the risks that are concerned in this field and in the life sciences in general.
But, right now some of the stuff you're rolling around the news is that they have a new vaccine, they hope, against Ebola. That may or may not work. We'll see. Vaccines do, and they don't sometimes, so we'll see. Hopefully it will. Wouldn't it be possible, though, for someone to analyze the Ebola virus DNA, tweak it so that now it's no longer responsive to the vaccine, but yet still infected, maybe even more infected, and create a new synthetic creature, so to speak? Is that possible?
It's possible, but technically it'd be incredibly difficult to do. And one of my favorite things is that the biggest and best bioterrorist out there is Mother Nature.
Yeah.
Yes. She's very good at yeah. different permutations and combinations. Just look at seasonal flu, and there you go. But that is a risk, but it's very low probability.
Right. Okay. Well, Mother Nature does have a way of cleaning up the population when it gets too big. And she's been doing that for eons. But bioterrorism isn't new. I mean, ancient armies used to throw sick and dead cattle in water supplies and catapult plague victims over the walls and all kinds of stuff. So, I mean, it's been around since antiquity. And isn't that really the same thing that they're trying to do now is to demoralize, to damage someone's fighting capability and to create, chaos and terror, so to speak. Isn't it really the same thing with if you're throwing a cow over the infected cow over a fence or you're creating nasty creatures to go do bad stuff to people? Isn't it pretty much the same thing?
Well, that still goes to the heart of intent. And so if someone's going to want to do something, the analog of throwing carcasses over a wall, right, understood. But the one thing we do recognize is that that barrier to entry is getting lower. The capabilities are getting better, and the costs are going down at the same time. So there is that vulnerability. There is no identified threat, but we have to recognize that there is that risk exists, and it does develop certain vulnerabilities for us.
And I just want to follow up on a little bit of that. Again, I agree with Ed's comment that Mother Nature is this incredible engine of generating biological diversity, some of which you know, can be harmful. But we've seen a really interesting application in the last few years where this synthetic biology is being used as an incredible force of good to conquer things like seasonal flu. There was a presentation that I attended last year where it was described by a scientist, Dr. Philip Dormitzer of Novartis, and their work with a company in San Diego, Synthetic Genomics, where they were able to receive a new flu sample digitally that had been sequenced in China, I believe. So the digital code of the new flu was transmitted to San Diego, and there in just a few days they were able to engineer an attenuated flu vaccine specific to that new flu, even before a biological sample had been approved and shipped to the U.S., they were able to make an attenuated vaccine that could be used for seeding the bioreactors necessary to make millions of doses. So this is really one of a tremendous acceleration and precision in vaccine development. I believed it was the most significant advance I had seen in my lifetime in terms of vaccine development. But again, you're using those synthetic technologies as a counter weapon. I don't believe we've seen an actual applied use of synthetic biology for anything malicious to date. And I believe that because that these technologies are built on a foundation of digital tools, if we were to see that, law enforcement would have an incredibly rich trove of information to go and hunt down the people involved and bring them to justice. There is so much digital information and traces today that simply were not available 10 years ago.
Well, obviously, you know, potential for good, potential for bad, as we've talked about, dual use and all that is real. So tell us a little bit about the FBI Weapons of Mass Destruction Directorate, the WMDD it's called. What is that? What's its mission? How did it get started? What does it do?
Sure. The WMDD Directorate is one of the youngest divisions within the FBI. Its core mission is to prevent, detect, deter, and respond to WMDs, so basically individual groups trying to develop, acquire, or use a WMD, and that is our primary mission to prevent that. And the director was born out of the events of September 11, 2001, those devastating attacks. And then, if you recall, less than a month after those attacks, we had the anthrax mailings. And so that, those two events were seminal moments for the U.S. government and for the FBI in particular. The FBI has over 100 years in tradition and as a law enforcement agency. We are very good at what we do in investigations, but if you think about it, that's inherently reactive, meaning that a crime or an incident occurs and then you go in afterwards to conduct your investigation, collect evidence, identify the perpetrators, and bring them to justice. Well, 9/11 was the wake-up call, and the FBI, in response, changed its mission priorities, and our number one priority now is not one of response, but now one of prevention. So how do we proactively prevent another 9/11 or another anthrax mailing type incident from occurring again? And as a result of the findings based on the 9/11 Commission and the WMD Commission, the FBI consolidated all the different elements necessary for this mission, and thus was born the WMD Directorate.
So, the WMDD has three sections. You have investigations and operations section, the IOS, the countermeasures section, CS, and the intelligence and analysis section. So can you describe what each of those do and how they coordinate with each other?
Sure. So if you think about it, I'm part of the countermeasures operations section. We are the tip of the spear on the prevention side of the house, where it is, for example, my job is to look at emerging areas, areas that could potentially be misused or exploited, setting up tripwires to detect criminal activity or misuse. And if something like that should happen, then our investigations and operations section, those are the folks that actually help manage the actual investigation if there was an evidence of a crime. And the intelligence analysis section, those are our folks who bring it all together. They tie it all. And develop and look at the different threat streams. If you think of a series like 24, for example, it's a well-oiled machine where you have the field offices out there who respond to the actual events or respond to potential reports of suspicious activities. Then our analysts provide the relevant information not only to our personnel, but the other members of the federal government, and it really is a joint effort. The one key program element that I should mention is there's a specific position within the director called WMD coordinators. They are the cornerstone of our program. So in each of our 56 field offices across the U.S., there's at least one special agent that's trained in chemical, biological, radiological matters. These men and women act as the local ambassadors to state and local law enforcement and public health. Their primary mission is to reach out to universities and companies, institutions, to develop the important notification protocol so that if anything ever did happen, now at the local level, folks know who to contact within the FBI. So I provided the example that there was a report who attempted to order smallpox DNA through the mail, and as a result, these synthetic DNA companies now screen customers and orders, which is fantastic. But if you think about it, if they ever did run across a suspicious order, who do they contact? They're not going to be able to report that to their local police department. Say if it came from Iran or something like that. But we introduced them, our program, to the WMD coordinators, and now they know who they can reach out to for further vetting. They, our headquarters section provides the backstopping and help with the assessment. So this element of the FBI now being a resource for the private sector has been very, very well received.
So I'm just wondering, just to follow up a little bit on that, one of the things that seemed to me sort of clear to a lot of people, even before 9/11, especially with the anthrax cases, is wondering how well prepared local law enforcement and other organizations, certainly not all just strictly a law enforcement response, but just in terms of public safety, public health. Are local communities set to respond to these, and does this part of the agency help with that at all, or does that fall somewhere else?
No, absolutely. That's where those coordinators are vital. If, for example, a scenario that there was an unusual outbreak of some kind, we provide training in partnership with the CDC to have our local partners, law enforcement, public health, work together to quickly run down whether or not was this intentional or is this a naturally occurring event, all the way through possible, there was a couple of, 2 years ago, there were those very high-profile cases where some very disturbed individuals attempted to mail ricin to the president. In those instances, the WD coordinators and the respective field offices were the lead investigators, and they worked very closely with their local partners, also with public health and the postal inspection services. So on the front end, we do a lot of engagement and coordination with our other federal partners, as well as the important elements at the local level.
So what's the scope of this threat? I mean, how big is it? What are the possibilities? What are your major concerns? What do you see as the big problems, and what specifically are we trying to guard ourselves against?
So there are two aspects. The first one, as I mentioned, is how do we prevent, detect, and deter and respond to the misuse of the life sciences or synthetic biology. Oftentimes, for example, when you talk about security in this realm, we tend to go to the far end of the spectrum where, you know, the sci-fi scenario of 28 days later where someone engineers a world-ending virus. Yes, there is that possibility, although it's incredibly unlikely. But then there is some other aspect, too. So, for example, just a few months ago, there was a scientific paper that came out where a synthetic biology lab was able to engineer baker yeast to produce morphine. And, you know, it's a very beneficial application because there's a huge need for pain control medications in our healthcare sector. However, we do run the risk of, you know, if you now have a microbe that can produce potent narcotics for you, you can run the risk of drug cartels maybe exploiting this technology to, if hypothetically this became more disseminated, then we're on the verge of potentially going from Breaking Bad to Brewing Bad. That becomes an incredible challenge for organizations like the FBI and the Drug Enforcement Administration. But again, that is really focusing, the first point is, you know, identifying specific specified intent for criminal use and protecting against that. Another part of our program is to do a lot of outreach and engagement to the life sciences community, to the synthetic biology community, to provide that security awareness and what their role and the FBI's role is in safeguarding science. The second part that I should note is that one of the reasons why we do outreach and not become very prescriptive is in the interest of security, if you put in a whole bunch of barriers and making very difficult for innovators like Andrew Hessel to be able to do his work, that in all then becomes a national security issue too, because you don't want to put measures in place that stifles innovation for vaccine development, countermeasures, or biodefense. So there really is a very important balance that needs to be struck in ensuring that you address the threat, but then also in a position to support and reinforce scientific research.
And I just want to jump on that and just say absolutely, when I think of the real risk today and, you know, the weapon of mass destruction is really the, you know, these pandemic viruses that can, you know, can injure or harm hundreds of thousands of people just as they circulate, cancer affecting one in three people in the world, and new emerging diseases, even just the old forwards, diabetes. You know, we treat diabetes with insulin. There are many other diseases, rare diseases, that simply don't have medicines made because they're not large enough markets. This is where these technologies can be applied and do tremendous good.
Let me ask you about this. You may not be able to answer the question for lots of reasons, but one is, Ed, for you, I mean, has the WMDD interfaced with any real threats that specifically they had to come and put a boot on that we may or may not be aware of. And secondly, Andrew, in your world, you mentioned this, you know, if you can get on the internet and learn how to make a bomb and pipe bombs and whatever, so you can build a nuclear weapon on there if you have the right materials. But everything's out on the internet with your open source community, which is a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful thing. Have you at any time run across any communications, any cross-pollination that's made you say, I'm not sure I'm comfortable with this?
So I just made reference to a couple of cases that,
right,
that deal with biologicals. We had the Dusky case where a karate instructor had a vendetta against a Elvis impersonator. And he tried to frame the Elvis impersonator by sending a letter to President Obama with laced with ricin. But that sparked a WMDD investigation, and we leveraged those important federal criminal statutes dealing with preventing the misuse of biology that I had mentioned before. And as a result of that experience, though, we've also implemented outreach to some of the major nursery suppliers in the country, because the karate instructor, he obtained the castor genes that were necessary to extract the ricin from legitimate retail stores. So it really does show that there are interesting challenges to be had. The second case was an actress, the Richardson case. I mean, her claim to fame was being a zombie extra on The Walking Dead, and she tried to frame her husband and mail ricin in his name to the president as well. So some interesting characters, but it highlights that that there are some inherent challenges not only in trying to identify the bad actors, but the fact is, the life sciences, biology, it's naturally occurring in the environment. And, you know, it's really looking at how do you manage those types of threats in a manner that you don't negatively impact the legitimate community. So that's just those cases, a couple of the more recent cases that we've had.
And I guess if you get a population big enough, you're going to get some outliers.
Yeah, exactly.
So, what is WMD counterproliferation, and what programs are in place for that?
Right. So counterproliferation is basically the loss of our technology or our specific equipment to support an adversary program. And, you know, there have been plenty of Hollywood movies about people trying to steal mechanisms for a nuclear device or whatnot. Those little widgets that are classified, I mean, that's pretty much, I would say, common sense if you think about it. But again, if you look at it from, if you put the bio lens on it, it becomes incredibly difficult. If you think about it that way, then the proliferation space in bio, it's done, it's over. I mean, it's already, because you're talking about materials that are naturally occurring in the environment, the knowledge and materials that are published in scientific journals, and again, it goes to the heart of what Andrew does. Biology research in particular is wholly beneficial and has been wholly open source from the beginning, and I'm sure Andrew would want to weigh in on that.
I tend to, I appreciate that biology has been open source from the beginning. In fact, I usually say that biology is the only thing we all have in common. The scary idea in my mind would be trying to stop biology from getting on an airplane. We move biology around the world every single day. It's our lack of understanding about biology, the molecular systems, the microbiomes, the natural flow of viruses and genetic information, the migration of organisms. Today that is really creates much of the fear. most of the people that I know don't have a deep understanding of cellular biology. They don't have an appreciation of the microbial and viral diversity that's out in the world. And whenever there's a lack of understanding, there's fear. And so one of the things that I really think is important about the digitization of these technologies is not just about synthetic biology, it's also about our growing ability to read DNA, to be able to detect biological molecules and biological particles, to better map ecosystems that is emerging from some of these technologies, creating large new data sets that ultimately will get processed into knowledge and hopefully make us feel more comfortable and empower us more capabilities for not only improving human health, but giving us a much better understanding of biological systems and ecosystems. So this is, I think, part of just the emergence of an entirely new but yet unfamiliar environment and platform. And as we get more comfortable with it, I think we'll be able to better distinguish what is a worst case scenario or extremely rare event, that type of fear, from where are the practical safeguards and detection systems and monitoring systems and precautions that need to be put in place.
You're so right about that. We see this also just even with people's response to crime things. I've written serial killer books. I know serial killers and monsters we all fear. They're so rare. When my mom started watching these shows and got a favor, I said, you really need to be worried about things that are microscopic. Been on the attack against humanity for a long time. That's what's going to get you. recently the FBI, along with the American Association for the Advancement of Sciences, developed an outreach program. She's DIY biotechnologist. So tell us what DIY biotechnologists are. What is that?
I think I'm going to have Andrew answer what DIY Bio is, and then I'll explain what the FBI has been doing.
So the iGEM community, International Genetically Engineered Machines Program, was a program that started up at MIT to really train a new generation of young scientists in some of these technologies and inspire them to explore the capabilities of made possible by this type of engineering in under the umbrella of academic institutions and experienced leadership. And after a few years of that program running, a few of the young scientists in the program decided that they didn't want to do this just for the 4 or 5 months a year that this program was running. They wanted to do this all the time. So they organized a website called Do It Yourself Biology, DIYBio.org. And it set up there was an immediate response to this. People thought, oh, this is fascinating. And there were so many areas of biology that they wanted to explore, often just through communications and meetups, but sometimes moving towards more experimentation. And it set up, their new locations started to pop up around the world. People started to found community labs that were organized very much like gyms. A membership fee would get you into the facility. You would take some safety courses, and then training courses would be offered. And it would allow various types of simple biological experimentation and analysis to be done, and just a great place for sharing. But this, over time, some of the projects, some of the these communities have started to become much more sophisticated, And having an outreach program into this community is certainly worthwhile. In my experience now, a lot of these DIY biologists have continued in their training, and in fact, many of them are becoming entrepreneurs today. But I'll leave it to Ed to elaborate more on the actual outreach program.
Right, so as Andrew mentioned, I mean, this is a community that is very enthusiastic about science. Some of them are actually very much dismayed at the decline in science literacy in the U.S., and they want to see themselves as an ability to galvanize the population to become interested and excited about biology again. They range from, garage labs, range all the way to community labs built around the framework of, say, a gym model, as Andrew mentioned. So the FBI, we recognized that this was, again, a beneficial, innovative activity, because this is a community that also believes that the next Bill Gates or Steve Jobs is going to come out with something powerful from their garages. So early on in the beginnings of this movement, we reached out to them and then basically invited held annual conferences where we brought in representatives from the DIY bio community and brought in their respective WD coordinators, though that has been a very important position in our program. So it's, again, showing what their role is in safeguarding science, showcasing to our WD coordinators that there is this growing amateur community so that, you know, one day maybe the neighbor of a DIY buyer might see the garage door open. They'll freak out and think, oh, my God, there's a methamphetamine lab next door. But if the local police report, they're going to report that to our coordinators, and the coordinators are aware of this community now. So what we've done is one of the challenges, this is because it is community-based, unlike Hollywood, how Hollywood portrays, we are not Big Brother. We don't have the legal authority, but to observe and watch everybody. But you know, sorry to disappoint folks.
Or the interest, I'm sure.
So maybe I shouldn't blow away our stereotype. But the important thing is, one of the things that we gained from this outreach is that I would say we supported the development of a neighborhood watch mentality within the community, and who best to ensure that their important work is not exploited or abused in any way than actual members of the community. So they've, in effect, become deputized and are looking after themselves. And they now know that if they see something that doesn't seem right or suspicious, they have a trusted, identified face within the FBI in the form of their WD coordinator who they can now contact. So to me, that's a very powerful statement, and I should also note and confess that I'm currently cleaning out my garage because I fully intended on having my own garage lab myself. So I'm waiting for a community lab to open up in my neighborhood because I was kind of right off of that.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like a great thing, and any of you who are sitting around wondering what to do with your estate, here's something good to give them. Here's a nonprofit and help science be furthered in your local community. But I'm just to sort of clarify, because from what interests me about this, are these primarily people who are already trained in sciences? Maybe they're working, say they're day gigs in aerospace or something, and then or in some place where maybe they're not doing research. But they want the chance. So are they generally people who are already, a Bachelor's of Science above, or are these also people who are just amateurs interested in science, say, sort of on the model where a lot of our present-day science or modern science began, is with amateurs with the means to experiments and a lot of curiosity. So is it a mixture, or is it primarily people with already have a science background?
Oh, it runs the whole gamut. Yes, you have some fully trained PhD individuals, and all the way down to folks who are artists. And doing, you know, very interesting things. The community labs that I mentioned, they go out and they teach, they go to street fairs and teach kids how to extract DNA from strawberries using dish soap, rubbing alcohol, salt, and a coffee filter. So it really is, you have things like that always, as Andrew mentioned, some really cool innovation coming up and actual startups evolving out of this community.
Wow. Well, you mentioned, coffee filters and soap and all that for extracting DNA. So one of the questions is, in this day and age, we're worried, obviously, about lone wolves of all types, whether they're radicalized people who shoot up police stations and military bases, or, kids that go in and hack sophisticated computer systems. It's amazing what a 14-year-old can do with an iMac. But I would imagine not just anyone can synthesize DNA or viruses or something more sinister. I imagine it takes a certain amount of skill and a certain level of education and then equipment, certain types of equipment. What would be, from your point of view, what would be the minimal that someone would have to do to be able to at least enter that arena?
I've actually been exploring some of that just through my own work. I'm working with a global software company that doesn't have a background in life science. So in some ways, we're coming at it in very much the same way as a novice, although with much more care and attention and resources. So we're taking these steps carefully and slowly and learning along the way. And it turns out you need a considerable amount of expertise and equipment and facilities and money to move forward with this. Now, it's getting easier, but I can say that right now having access to a company that synthesizes DNA is not particularly difficult, but making any synthetic DNA that can actually be used to make a virus or a weapon would be very difficult. My exploration going forward was with one of the most common and essentially proven harmless model viruses to explore the path. The technology only recently became available. Every sequence that I sent was scanned. It took really discussion with the providers to understand what the experiments were about. We are a verified vendor, and it wasn't trivial when it came to cost. So it's a pretty high bar, and there are a number of safety checks in process. It will get faster and cheaper to move forward with these technologies, but at the same time, I also expect much more sophistication in the scanning and in the entire workflow to look for abuses.
Cool. And what is the FBI doing in this arena as far as looking for these individuals who are outside the mainstream, in other words, off the reservation?
Right. So, again, our whole approach is basically how do we better safeguard this whole field? And there's definitely a joint responsibility not only for the FBI but also for the members of the community. And it's not about us specifically identifying the bad guys, but it's a team effort, meaning that when we do our job right in conducting our outreach and engagement and education, we've effectively empowered the community to be on the lookout. If I borrow a term from the cyber world, we are trying to establish a generation of white hats, and to not only develop the sensitivity to be on the lookout for black hat activity, but then also to develop white hat applications and solutions for some of the security challenges that we've just discussed here on your show. One element of how we're approaching this, Andrea had mentioned iGEM, this really spectacular undergraduate level synthetic biology competition. Last year there were I think 2,500 students from all over the world, from I think it was 140 or so universities and from 30-plus countries. And my program were actually sponsors of iGEM, one of the sponsors. And so every year at iGEM, at the Jamboree, so think of a football bowl game combined with a science fair, and that's what the iGEM environment is like. Every year I host a FBI workshop called Safeguarding Science in the Future. And in this last iGEM Jamboree, I had 2,300 students in the auditorium with me. I had them all stand up, and they took a pledge for three things. One is to have fun, be passionate about what you're doing in your field, do good things to help the world. Second, be guardians of science, you know, prevent the misuse, exploitation, abuse of synthetic biology. And third, and probably most importantly, is to pass it on. Become mentors of the next generation of the others that are coming, that are following them. And to showcase what happens when you do this type of education outreach, one of my favorite stories is back in 2010, a team from China, from Beijing University, one of the universities there, at iGEM, they did a science summer science project, but they also decided to do a security side project. And these teenagers identified 17 Chinese-based biotech companies. And some of them, and all of them, had some potentially very dangerous, hazardous products. And the students ordered these products from all the companies, and to their dismay, found out that 16 out of the 17 companies were going to fill the order and mail them to basically apartment addresses. So the students canceled the orders before they shipped, and then they drafted a scathing letter criticizing the Chinese government for not doing a proper job in protecting the public and protecting industry, and sent it to the relevant Chinese government agencies. And to me, that's a home run. That's what you get when you want to develop a next generation of guardians of science, especially in such a rapidly developing field, because those students are going to be future CEOs of their own companies, future scientists, and hopefully future leaders in their respective countries as well. And now they've just been exposed to the FBI message and guardianship.
I just want to touch on one thing that Ed said about inspiring white hats and, you know, building a community of watchdogs. And you had asked earlier in your program about, well, why is the FBI reaching out to writers and researchers and working with book authors in Hollywood? And the reason for that is exactly as I explained earlier, that, you know, we want people, when we're talking to them and educating them about the role that they have in their own community, that they're not getting a bunch of, you know, erroneous, you know, negative, Big Brother type messages from the media, so that when we reach out to them and the WMD coordinators go into the communities, that they do have a warm reception and people are willing to listen to them. And that's why, you know, as I said, we encourage anyone who is, you know, working on a novel, if they're trying to write about something that involves the FBI, to do as much research as they can. And if you have specific questions and you don't know how to move the plot forward, that's why we created the webpage that tells people how to ask us questions so we can help.
And it's wonderful. Thanks for doing it.
Well, you know, I'm also just to follow up on some of a couple of things we've talked about today. Are you seeing a lot more interdisciplinary? I mean, I think sometimes in any advanced study of any area, as time goes on, you sort of, there's a tendency to maybe become, I guess, I'll say more vertical and drill down into narrower and narrower subjects. But this sounds like it really moves sort of horizontally, that you mentioned having artists involved and others, that you and with writers, even in terms of communicating some of these ideas, that this sounds like you may be pulling in people from, I'm assuming, other scientific disciplines, technological disciplines, as well as from the arts. So it's really pretty broad base. Is that accurate perception, or
I can give you an example from my own team. The BioNano group at Autodesk is comprised of about 20 people. We have research scientists in chemistry, in synthetic biology and genetics, in computational chemistry and drug design, and nanotechnology, specifically a field called DNA origami. Supporting that, we have designers, we have roboticists, we have and of course the software engineering professionals that are required to really tie it all together, and that's backed up by an amazing support team with facilities, et cetera. So this is very multidisciplinary. That's just the infrastructure for people to start to explore and create. I've also been very impressed that there's been a tremendous appreciation of this field of design opening up, and in fact, the Museum of Modern Art has been in New York. Has been tracking some of the artistic culture that's starting to explore, you know, vital forms of art, the intersection, etc. So, absolutely, this is diversified across the board, just as we see with computing systems.
So, can you tell us what each of you are working on now?
I will be at IGEM again at the end of September, so you can see me there. And going to be continuing on our outreach and engagement mission, because as Andrew mentioned, this is a wide, diverse, rapidly evolving field. Even now, you're having middle school kids delving into molecular biology. So one of the challenges right now is how do we scale our outreach methods? How do we educate this up-and-coming generation to be guardians of science? That's going to be a real challenge. It's how do we get them when they're young and showcase that they absolutely have an important role to play in protecting biology and having an understanding of what the FBI's role is there to assist with that.
And on my end, I've been just working with my team to make the best possible tools for computer-aided design and manufacturing that we can. I've got a new position with the AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and the Lemelton Foundation, a partnership to go to do outreach work as an invention ambassador and raise awareness of these technologies among innovators and young inventors. So there's definitely some outreach there. And I'm continuing to work with the larger scientific community to better understand their directions, their needs, and really just starting to get a sense of where, you know, how we can better support them in the future.
Well, kind of to wrap this whole thing up, which has been just incredibly fascinating, what's on the horizon? Where are we going to go from here? In other words, if we had this conversation 15 or 20 years from now, what would we be talking about in the arena of biotechnology and nanotechnology and in the arena of bio-WMDs? Where would we be? What do you see in your crystal ball? Whoever wants to go first.
Well, one of the things we're currently doing now is to face the fact that these technologies are, we already take, you know, I think we all appreciate that how quickly they are developing. It is global in nature. So we are taking our message internationally to helping not only our universities, but international universities, foreign universities to understand this too. But, you know, here's a topic that we potentially have for a follow-on show is that I think in the future, synthetic biology is a tool. What really is going to be interesting are going to be the applications. And so one aspect is going to be precision personalized medicine, that pretty soon when you go into a doctor's office, you're going to offer up a cheek swab. They're going to sequence that DNA, check out your medical history, and then based on that determine what best course of therapy or best way to maintain your quality of life is going to be. You're going to have a medical tricorder from Star Trek be able to determine what you need to do on a daily basis. We're already starting to see that with wearable technology, you know, the Fitbits and Jawbones. the challenge though for the FBI in general and for everybody is what are the security considerations in that future? So there's nothing stopping me right now, Doug, Jan, if you discard a water bottle you just drank from, I pick it up and I swab it and I can send that in for sequencing. I now have your DNA sequence. You can do that today. But who knows how that potentially could be exploited or extorted in the future. So these are questions that go beyond privacy but are very much in the realm of security that we need to be discussing now.
And I'm happy to elaborate on some of this. So that, you know, when I'm described as a futurist in these technologies, I'm cheating in a bit. I'm following the example of what's been happening with computers, you know, for as long as I've been involved. And really, we know that they get better, faster, and cheaper. The living cell is really a type of living computer. It's a little squishy and wet, and DNA is a programming language. So I know that the cost is going to drop in synthesizing DNA. More people are going to come into it and start exploring the application space, as Ed pointed out. And so we're going to see a lot more experimentation and discovery happening. Predictably, some of this is going to be give rise to really new startup companies that are doing things people care about and think are important in the therapeutic space, the diagnostic space. I see it being an engine of the economy. I know we're going to get surprised by some of the developments. I know that it will probably give rise to new forms of or changes or reforms in regulatory and oversight architecture. So I can see whole new organizations being built, just as we now have security organizations that focus primarily in the cyber world. I see application spaces and really this becoming a tremendous career for kids. As you know, Bill Gates said that if he was young today, he would be programming cells, not computers. And eventually, this takes us off planet. We the mission of NASA is to really explore the universe and whether there's life in it. And if we're already looking at how do we bring technologies for detecting living systems, better ones than we've got today, to places like Mars, Europa, and other parts of our solar system, this has the potential to also allow us to engineer systems that will sustain humanity if they go venturing off this planet. So radical shifts in, not radical, but let's just say an evolution of our manufacturing technologies, our design technologies, our remediation and health technologies, tremendous new areas to explore.
And if the FBI has done our job right in educating the next generation, they'll be developing the solutions that from some of the security challenges. And hopefully some of these future iGEMers, synthetic biologists, or DIY biologists will become an FBI agent as well.
Excellent. Great answers. Well, Betsy, Ed, Andrew, I can't thank you enough for being on the show. I know that our listeners love this. And our listeners also know we have a lot of links on the various websites that Jan mentioned earlier for further study and further reading on these topics. Anyway, thank you so much for taking the time to educate our listeners and us on this incredible world.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
I'm happy to do it.
Until next time, that's this episode of Crime and Science Radio. Jan and I thank you all for listening in, and we'll be back with the next show. Thanks.